Welcome, everybody, to All About Symbian Insight number 93. I do apologise for 92 being a few days delayed. The dog ate the original artwork, as they say. With me, I have...
Rafe Blanford.
And Ewan Spence.
There we go. Right, cross-country compendium of journalists here. OK, on with some news. There's loads to talk about this week. I've no idea how we're going to fit it all into half an hour. Let's kick off, though, with the quarter three figures from Canalys. Widely looked at, widely expected, and I have to say the overall picture is much of a muchness. There's no real surprises. Symbian and Nokia trucking along and rising slightly here, falling slightly there, depending on where you look. iPhone still rising, RIM still rising, Windows Mobile still stagnating slightly. Rafe, were there really any surprises for you?
There weren't really any major surprises here. I think what this does illustrate is how all the talk of Symbian sales declining or Nokia being doomed or etc. doesn't really translate into real sales results. I mean, to summarize here, what you're seeing is, as we know, there was a decline in shipments from Q2 to Q3, but year on year, Nokia are actually up, and that's really because they had a particularly bad Q3, Q4. Well, actually, all of 2008 was pretty bad in terms of shipments of devices. And things are improving this year, partly is coming out of the recession, partly new product lines. I think there's some interest from the other platforms and other manufacturers. For example, HTC's market share has actually gone down, but that hides a more complex pattern where Windows Mobile has lost quite a lot of market share, but Android's selling better and actually appears on the charts for the first time, at least for Canalys. And as a result, HTC have actually sold a lot less Windows Mobile devices, but quite a few more Android devices. So are pretty on an even keel. And I think with the Windows Mobile 6.5 coming out at the beginning of Q4, that trend will be reversed. I think particularly if you look at the Samsung Omnia range with some of the Windows Mobile 6.5 devices, Windows Mobile is still going downwards, but I would expect a little uptick in the next quarter. Aside from that, I think the iPhone, again, it's continued to sell well. The Q3 2008 were exceptional results, and just after the iPhone 3G came out and when it started shipping more internationally. And it's actually only been able to sell slightly more in Q3 2009. Now, that's partly reflected by the fact that the 3GS actually went on sale slightly earlier. So some of the initial sales were in Q2, and you had a big uptick in Q2 compared to Q2 2008. But I think perhaps it's fair to say they're maybe slightly slower than one might have anticipated looking at the trend over time. The sales are still very healthy. I think the big story, if you're looking over a couple of years, is that BlackBerry have continued to do very well. They've continued to grow both their market share and their sales, which for a company that a lot of people have sort of had doubts about because of the age of its software platform, and that problem still very much exists, but also, being written off as an enterprise-only company, having 20% market share is a very impressive achievement, and they've continued to grow throughout the economic downturn, suggesting that I think their performance really is sort of the outstanding one in terms of open mobile platforms. But as you say, it's really business as usual. I suppose the only reflection would be that people who have been predicting big declines for Symbian market share, actually Canalys have them at 40%. It really depends how you count it. Nokia's own results say, I think, 36%, something like that. And I would emphasize that it is very cyclical, as I perhaps suggested with the iPhone results.
I should just emphasise to people listening to this that the reason Rafe's speaking so confidently about trends is partly because he has a very handy spreadsheet and a very handy graph. Now, if you look on All About Symbian under the headline Quarter 3 Smartphone Sales Figures Now Out, you'll see Rafe's incredibly handy trend over the last 2 years or so, broken down by quarter for all the major open mobile OS shipments, as he calls it. I'm trying to persuade Rafe to also put up a similar graph of by manufacturer, and apparently that's quite easy to generate. So hopefully, Rafe, you can get that up, and then we can see both sets of trends at once.
Yes, I'll get that up. And as I say, it's very much worth watching the trends over a year without sort of focusing on individual quarters or even, sequential results. That's quarter on quarter or year on year. Because as I say, smartphone industry is still very cyclical because outside of Nokia, most manufacturers are only producing a couple of devices a year. I mean, HTC is another exception, as is maybe RIM, the bigger companies. But otherwise, these results tend to be very much impacted by when a phone comes out. And even Nokia, with something like the 5800 in Q2 2009, has that kind of impact. And so, as I say, I would be wary of just looking at growth and share changes year on year or quarter on quarter, because sometimes they can be sort of put out of shape by, as I say, the cyclical nature of releasing devices.
It's also very interesting when you put those trends, when you look at the iPhone, it's amazing, it's taking off, it's selling absolutely everything. And then you look at the line for the BlackBerry, which essentially fits the same market, American smartphone users. The iPhone, apart from the part where the 3G got released, there was a dip before and a peak after, pretty much tracks underneath the BlackBerry sales. So the growth of the iPhone market is growing at roughly the same speed. It's the BlackBerry market. In other words, it's growing with the consumer. It's not bringing in new people per se. Otherwise, we'd have a hockey stick there. So, numbers don't lie. Boom.
let's move on to talking about the industry and major endorsements. In this case, Fujitsu and Quick now have joined the Symbian Foundation, which I think is, as Rafe mentioned in his commentary, is a major boost to the foundation. Rafe, can you just explain to listeners who Quick are?
So Quick are a company that's a wholly owned subsidiary of Qualcomm, and Qualcomm is probably best known for its chipset technology, but it's worth emphasizing there's an awful lot of software in there as well. They do work on browsers. They also have the Brew platform. So although Qualcomm's traditionally thought of as a sort of silicon company, it's actually sort of a mobile IP company in general, and has contributed a lot to things like 3G and LTE, which are obviously the standards by which data and voice is delivered to phones over a cell network. Quick is, as I say, a wholly owned subsidiary that's going to focus on contributing to open source projects. And the reason they've set it up is partly to set it up separately from Qualcomm, who has quite a lot of IP issues. I mean, Qualcomm are very well known, I think, for suing various people or being sued in turn over IP issues. And that's not a bad thing. I mean, Qualcomm have done a lot of innovation and put a lot of money in R&D. But in order to kind of free them of that, they've set up this company which will enable them to work with open source platforms like Android, like the Symbian Foundation. They're also going to be contributing to WebKit, and I believe another platforms, probably Limo as well. And they're going to have a dedicated team of engineers that will essentially contribute code to the open source platforms, which will enable companies to use Qualcomm technology. So it's not there is self-interest in this, very much so. But so the sort of thing they'll work on in the Symbian Foundation is making sure that the Qualcomm chipsets like Snapdragon are supported for the Symbian Foundation platform. And that will be making sure they tie in with things like Shy, which is the software hardware abstraction interface, which means Symbian will be able to run across a lot more hardware architecture going forward in Symbian 3 and 4. And they're very significant, I think, joining the Symbian Foundation. There's two reasons. One is they're very strong in America, so I think it gives the Symbian Foundation a very strong voice, a strong backer who may help them get into sort of operating markets that they might not otherwise have been able to do so. And I suspect we'll see the first sort of Symbian-powered with Qualcomm chipsets before too long. And the second important thing is that along with Fujitsu, they're actually going to be contributing to the finance of the Symbian Foundation. They're finance board members, and that's actually like Nokia, Sony Ericsson and Samsung, but unlike some of the other board members, I think it's the operators, Vodafone, and some of the silicon providers, STMicroelectronics and TI. So they're actually making a very significant financial commitment as well, and they're actually going to be replacing LG and Motorola, as was originally intended to be on the board. And I spoke to Lee Williams about this, and he actually felt that by bringing in Qualcomm and Fujitsu, they actually had a stronger board than they would have had with the earlier companies. And yes, there's going to be some interesting cultural things going on. And what he said to me was that the Symbian Foundation will be about the enablement of making these companies become more open. For example, Fujitsu and Qualcomm are both sort of, relatively speaking, focused on closed technologies previously. And Fujitsu, I guess we should just mention briefly, very important for the Japanese market. They've been a driving force behind MoAPS, which is the Symbian user interface or operator package that's used on the Japanese Symbian phones. And having them come in and really put a strong commitment to the Symbian Foundation platform is a big deal. And it shouldn't be forgotten that Fujitsu do a lot more than just mobile phones. And so there's all sorts of interesting things that could potentially happen with a Symbian Foundation platform in devices outside mobile phones. And it will also reinforce the Symbian's position as one of the dominant players as a smartphone platform in Japan, where actually not many people realize, Japan has the highest penetration of smartphones anywhere in the world, and Symbian has about 25% market share, which is biggest in the market. And that's of the total mobile market. You know, we're used to talking about percentages of about 10% for total smartphone penetration in the rest of the world, with Symbian at about 7%, depending on how you do the calculation. So it's an interesting market to watch, and a very good endorsement, I think, for the Symbian Foundation.
I was fascinated to see that the Fujitsu and Quick announcement was right at the end of the C2009 show. And obviously there must have been talks going on ahead of the show to set all this up. But they obviously didn't feel confident enough to announce it at the start of the show, and they had to wait for 2 days of, you know, meetings and handshakes and rubber stamping everything before they could finally announce it. And it kind of reinforced for me the fact that the show was really was this year all about networking, about making alliances, about shaking hands, about signing deals, and which is why it happened at the end of the show rather than the beginning, to try and catch the headlines. Does that sound about right?
That's absolutely right. I can give you a slight inside track. There's actually a Symbian Foundation board meeting on the last day of the show. And as you say, it would have all been set up beforehand in terms of many of the preparation meetings would have gone on beforehand, but it wasn't voted through by the rest of the board, which of course has to happen when you're appointing new people to the Symbian Foundation board under the governance rules under which the Symbian Foundation operates. So yes, but I do think it's a reflection of the fact that the Symbian show this year was really about coming together and meeting the creation of a community based around a whole new business philosophy. You know, the Symbian Foundation is very different to the old Symbian Limited company, and I think nothing can bear that out more than what we saw at the show over 2 days. And as you say, you know, this board announcement is a great example of that.
Yeah, it's a busy old show. You and I know, I didn't hear much from you on the second day. I just imagine you must have had your head down writing away and producing podcasts and interviewing people. So what were your recollections of last Tuesday and Wednesday?
Well, 2 out of 3 ain't bad, yeah. what was fun, and again, we've alluded to that, is that this was the first show for the Symbian Foundation, not the 10th show for Symbian as .com, and it was just gentle. There wasn't a massive call to arms or a rising, and on the second day it was, you know, go around a nice long chat with Opera, people like Navtech, which, you know, a lot of people would have heard that in the second podcast that came from the floor. But there wasn't a lot of stress. It wasn't very, I mean, there was a corporate feel, but there was lots of, you know, what are you up to nowadays, what are you driving forward. And one of my big observations was the fact that people like TechCrunch weren't there, people like Mashable or The Next Web weren't there, and also, you know, mainstream, The Guardian, BBC Tech. I mean, this is a big event in London's doors. Even though it's B2B, there was nothing there to get the main sort of press in. And I wonder if that's because the outreach didn't happen, or the outreach did happen, and all those sites, you know, on their own decided that it wasn't for them. And I found that interesting, especially right afterwards. You know, people were, you know, going, Symbian's dead, and we had the stuff about the N-Gage, which we may well come on to in this or the next show coming up at the end of that. But yeah, just a sort of quiet confidence. But the problem is, I think that quiet confidence can easily be portrayed as not having any focus, not having any drive or ambition. There was a lovely section in the keynote from Lee Williams where he was talking about NFC technology coming up in Symbian Power 3 and Symbian Power 4. And, you know, it's like, and you'll be able to take your phone and be able to touch it to authorize it for Bluetooth, and you'll be able to touch it over here, and you'll have your pairing, touch it here. And all I was thinking while that was on was, you know, if it had been an Apple presentation, it'd be, you take your iPhone, you touch, boom, connect, touch, boom, pay, touch, boom. You know, there wasn't the sort of, look at us, this is really good. It was, you know, if you look carefully, you'll find something nice. And it's a different market that Symbian's in, and the press are in another one. And I don't know how they get around that problem, because much as they sell lots of devices, much as it's driving a lot of things, you know, they're not winning the PR war with the 60 or 70 tech journalists in the world that they need to get the coverage that Droid is getting, for example. Right?
Yeah, no, I think there's several interesting points here, and I'll come back to my own feelings on CO9 in a minute. But to address this media issue, I do think it's one that Symbian needs to address, but, you know, it's historically, it's been there for quite a while. I find it pretty hard to understand why, you know, a platform that, you know, really dominates mobile, and you can, you know, ask about where it's going in the future, but at the moment it does dominate mobile, and certainly the predictions from the analysts, and I'd certainly agree with this, that it's going to be the majority platform going forward, and yet it receives very little attention. As you say, you're in, you know, a new phone like Droid comes out and it gets a huge amount of attention, or you know, the Android 2.0 announcement came out, actually I think it was the first day of the Symbian show, and that attracted immediate media attention. But when I say media attention, I think it's fair to say that it's actually very much the kind of the web media and the sort of Silicon Valley tech, and because Symbian doesn't have that strong presence in America, it's seriously affected there. Now, how important is that? It's difficult to tell. With the sort of domestic media, the UK media, I think it's pretty inexcusable not to have people along at least talking about it, because some of the things that we'll be talking about were very interesting. And the Symbian Foundation is looking to establish effectively an open source business model, you know, a non-profit foundation, you know, looking to create something that may very well be very important, you know, future way of doing business, and something that could be in, you know, business schools as a case study. This is how you can transform your organization to, you know, a new open model and more collaborative. And so I think there's an awful lot to be learned from it. And yes, it does surprise me, but I think, you know, Symbian are just going to have to work at it slowly. I think part of the problem was that the show itself was actually a lot smaller than it has been in previous years. And, you know, a lot of people said that was reflective of, you know, Symbian going down the tubes. I don't really think so. I mean, partly it was a reflection of the reduced budget for the show as a result of partly the economic downturn, but also the fact that the Symbian Foundation is now non-profit. But it was also, I think, a reflection of the sharpening of the focus of the show. You know, this wasn't a consumer show at all anymore. And previously, I always felt that, you know, the Symbian show was a bit Janus-like. It was two-faced. And as a result, sometimes fell between two stools. You know, a consumer on one hand with, you know, the shiny new devices out there, a couple of device announcements, you know, lots of software provided, but never really felt that added a lot of value outside of, you know, other conferences, be it Nokia World or Mobile World Congress. And it, you know, didn't quite serve developers either. Yet this time round, it did serve developers. And what I found most remarkable of all was the two big themes behind the Symbian Foundation, which are community and contributions, really came out very strongly. And if you wandered around the show floor, you know, you would talk to some people who, you know, perhaps were more negative on Symbian, but equally, well, you saw companies coming together, working in little groups of who might be regarded as competitors, thinking, yes, this is a contribution that we can give to the Symbian Foundation. And we saw the first examples of that from things like Ixnos, but and also Sun and the web dev and the WebCal support. CalDev support, I should say. And I thought that was very interesting. And I saw an awful lot of that going in small corners, people getting together and talking, collaborating about, you know, the future of the platform. And people still haven't quite grasped just how big a change it is for Symbian to move to the Symbian Foundation in terms of the way the platform is going to be put together. And what's quite, to be honest, it's a radical agenda, this kind of openness that we just haven't seen before anywhere. And Lee Williams made a point of doing a media tour in the US and saying, you know, Android isn't open in the same way that Symbian Foundation is. It doesn't have the same governance regulations. It is dominated by Google, whereas the Symbian Foundation is genuinely something different. Now, how much of that is, you know, PR spin is open to debate. But I think actually, if you look at the governance and the way things are working, it is true. And as an example of this, you know, I was sitting down in the media hall, and one of the Symbian reps came over to me and said, I want you to meet the CEO of Lair, Ramos, who had given a presentation earlier, and he'd sort of mentioned that Lair would be coming to Symbian and will arrive in sort of March next year. But it was very early on. They were looking for a developer, and, you know, the Symbian Foundation was introducing them to people, being a foundation of enablement rather than sort of doing all the coding themselves. And I found that very interesting. But we also had, you know, Ted Shelton came down and sat down and introduced himself and goes to the Lair CEO, what can we do? And they didn't mind that I was sitting there. In fact, they were saying, it's great that you can see this openness in action. And I want to write an article on this, because it really was, you know, remarkable to see that kind of conversation going on in the open. And they didn't mind. In fact, they were encouraging contributions from other people who are in the room, and also from myself. And I just haven't ever seen anything like it in mobile. I was really quite blown away by the openness. And when you talk to people who have been actively involved in Symbian for a long time, that message of community, the ethos of open source, sort of combining with the commercial world, I think was very strong. And of course, you know, it was set against the background that there weren't really any big Symbian Foundation announcements, as Steve mentioned the Fujitsu and Quick one came the day afterwards. I think the big press release that we were handed as we went into the medium was about Symbian Horizon, which has already been announced, a big deal. But that's a reflection of the fact that the Symbian Foundation's only been going 6 months and people are already writing it off, which is ridiculous. You know, you can't really judge the Symbian Foundation until the first full platform under its guise come out. And arguably, that's not going to happen until Symbian 3 or even Symbian 4. And then you may give it a year and say, can we judge its efforts after that? And I think the signs at the moment are there has been a hiatus while it converted. Whatever Symbian might like to claim, there's been a hiatus while they switch from one to the other. But things seem to be picking up now, and so the judgment actually needs to take place in 2 years' time. And anyone writing off the Symbian Foundation now, I think, does so at their peril. You know, look at it as the way it's innovating in its business model, but also the way it's attempting to innovate its platform by getting in contributors from the outside, the whole community coming together to create the sort of next generation platform. And everybody knows that there are issues involved. And people immediately point to the UI. I agree with it, absolutely. There's a contribution coming from Nokia to fix that, and yet they miss the fact that there's all kinds of other interesting things going on an already very mature platform, which outside of sort of UI and App Store distribution is, you know, industry leading by some way. So, you know, that's a sort of long-winded rant and way of saying that people should be paying more attention to the Symbian Foundation because it is doing something very different and it's already dominant into the marketplace. So why wouldn't you be coming to talk to them and find out what's going on instead of writing them off without having a detailed understanding of what's going on? Okay, long waffle and rant over.
But they'll be dead within 2 years, don't you understand? There's nobody there. There's nobody buying. All the developers are running away from them. Nobody's coding for them. Nobody's doing anything for them. They're dead. They can't even get tables into their press room for crying out loud.
So calm down,
everybody else who's listening to the podcast and saying that, to which we say we refer our honorable gentleman to the answer Rafe gave some hours ago.
Yes, sorry for that rather long-winded rant, but it's been coming on a while.
Okay. Let's move on. In a rather low-key announcement last week, as we record this, by its own blog, came the news that Nokia plans to shutter its N-Gage gaming service. In actual fact, they tried to phrase it, quite rightly, that they're merging it all into the Obi store service. Current N-Gage games can be purchased until September next year, so it's a fairly long lead time here. And the website and arena and online elements will all be available throughout the whole of next year. But ultimately, though, it does seem like the N-Gage brand is doomed to die. Ewan, do you want to comment on this?
The N-Gage brand was doomed to die in October 2003 because they said it had too big a launch fight and sent it out with bad technology.
Yeah, it really is doomed this time.
It really is doomed this time, yes. N-Gage, after September 2010, will be dead. You won't be able to activate any more games, so we're told. It's okay, we'll move to Movi Store. Well, you know, a year and a bit ago, you said we could transfer N-Gage games from one handset to another. We still haven't been able to manage that. I kind of feel really, really disappointed about this because Nokia did have this. They were in the right place at the right time. And I alluded there back to October 2003. They released the original N-Gage handset. And let's face it, it was a great idea. It was a gaming device which had mobile phone circuitry and connectivity, which you're starting to see now very heavily in the iPhone as a gaming platform, in the Sony PSP, and in the Nintendo DSIs. There's even rumors that Nintendo are going to put a 3G circuit in the next release of the DS, of the smaller DS, in the US to allow for that connectivity. But Nokia made a series of implementation errors. You had to listen to the original N-Gage device on its site, hence side talking. Everybody had an immediate joke, and that's as far as the reviews went. They set the price too high on the handset. You know, they said, well, you know, we're going to charge about $300-$400 for this. Eventually, the price came down. And, you know, along the way, Nokia, in this sense, were essentially the Gordon Brown of gaming. At every point where you could make a decision, if there was a decision that would improve the platform in the eyes of everybody or not improve the platform in the eyes of everybody, Nokia invariably chose a decision that didn't improve the platform in the eyes of everybody. Right, they had the QD come along. That's great. But they announced in October, they released the first device in October, and there were no games. QD came along, and, you know, nobody really got it. They didn't do any push behind it. They didn't buy advertising in the gaming magazines, which meant the gaming magazines went, well, we're just going to make a joke in this to prove that we're editorially independent. Nah, 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 nah. Then they closed down the N-Gage hardware and spent 2.5 years building an app store for the N-Gage to run on every single client, every single handset through client. When they did release it, it didn't run on every handset. And when they did, there were fundamental problems, like how do you download a game when you lose it again? How do you copy your save files over? Why is it not advertised? Why are you not marketing it in the gaming press? At every point, they had the right idea. They had the right infrastructure, but the implementation was shocking. And even closing it down, even when they come to the final coup de grace, you know, buying it a nice ticket to Switzerland, giving it a comfy bed, putting on an episode of Columbo and, you know, pressing the button to drop the potassium chloride into the room, they couldn't even manage that properly. They closed it down without having an option for people to move to. We're going to move stuff into the OV store in the future. No, you should have done that before you closed. We're going to move the community over. You should have done that before you announced the closure. We don't know what we're going to do with the old games or the activation codes. You should have answered that before you went to close it down. The closure of N-Gage basically shows exactly why the rest of the N-Gage failed. Nokia had the right idea, which in this case was to put everything into OV, but failed to implement.
So Ewan, you've been talking a lot about N-Gage Classic and N-Gage QD, but couldn't you sort of say that the N-Gage Next Generation or N-Gage 2, however you want to refer to it, in terms of kind of the ease of use of downloading stuff, sort of effectively a mini app store and the arena functionality, wasn't that rather ahead of its time? I mean, don't we see that stuff now in the sort of PlayStation Network and the same on the DS to an extent?
Indeed, yeah. I think we're going to look back and see that Nokia had the right ideas. They were doing the right thing, but the implementation was poor. They didn't get the client out into the firmware. It didn't go out into all the handsets that could run it again.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And the other thing is, I mean, you've been quite negative on the Ovi store there, but isn't it more sensible to go that way rather than having two systems running in parallel? Isn't it maybe a question they need to tweak the Ovi store in some way to sort of promote the games more, have some effective marketing?
They should have done that before closing N-Gage.
They should, yeah. But do you think it's possible to create something within Ovi store that's still an effective games channel if they get the messaging?
Absolutely.
The
what they should have done,
indeed,
guys.
Yeah.
What they should have done is announced, okay, good news, everybody. We're upgrading the N-Gage store. It's now going to be part of the Ovi store and will inherit new capabilities, new software, new incentives, and new publishers and developers. It's going to be better.
But you'll still have everything you already have. You'll still have your forum. You'll still be able to have your games. You'll be able to transfer them now. You just go to ngage.ov.com. Exactly. Yeah. Great idea, crap implementation.
Yeah.
It's given the right idea and the right implementation.
And I think what's also interesting in terms of frustration for developers, you know, Nokia spent a lot of money buying Sega for some of the online gaming elements, sort of the Snap SDK, etc. And also that was used as the base of their arena functionality. And in the announcement about closing N-Gage, they sort of said, yes, we realise this is important and we'll be communicating later about a replacement for it. And I thought, surely that's a missed opportunity. You know, they should be communicating with developers now about how they can easily add the multiplayer, the top scores online, etc., to their game in a standard Nokia infrastructure that could be part of Ovi Store. And not only does it tie developers into Ovi Store more effectively, you know, it gives them a way of transferring stuff over. So it did strike me as a particularly missed opportunity on the developer front, let alone the consumer front that we've just been talking about.
Yeah. Talking of communication, and at this time an example of good communication, I want to give a shout out to Nokia in terms of their N97 firmware team. A couple of days ago, as we record this is on the Tuesday evening, I attended a virtual Q&A with Nokia's Frank Zilikens and Katalin Georgiou, I hope I pronounced those right,
who are basically
responsible for the version 20 firmware update for the N97, which came out about a week and a half ago. Basically to answer questions of journalists, bloggers and website owners, technical questions about the version 20 firmware. And it's great to see a really techie team from within Nokia getting involved in the coalface, as it were, in terms of communicating with the wider world in this way. It lasted for about an hour, and I'll just summarize a couple of the answers. They didn't really get into the technical details in the way I was hoping, but they did promise to answer some of my more technical questions and get back to us. So I will report about that more on the site. That people ask, of course, what about the new memory model for PR 2.0, the version 20 firmware? And the answer was, yes, we have reworked the application memory mapping model, and it does use RAM more efficiently and reduces memory errors. Now, people have still been having errors, especially with third-party applications, and I suspected that third-party apps don't use this new memory mapping model, but they assured me it did. So watch this space on this. I know Gravity has been having a few problems, and the author of Gravity in particular has been trying to reduce the RAM requirements, so hopefully that will cease to be a problem. And from my own experience with N97 version 20, I have noticed that the performance is quite a bit better, and it's providing I stay away from really heavy RAM hogs. I can quite easily run 10 or 12 programs at the same time, just as I used to on previous S60 third edition devices. It was asked about internet radio, which is still missing in action for S60 5th edition, and the answer came out rather limply. We are currently evaluating the internet radio feature for N97, but it is still in an early phase, and I fail to see how it can be in an early phase when it's actually been out for 2.5 years on S60 3rd edition. All they've got to do is add a bit of touch optimization to the UI, so I'm afraid that was not a very good answer.
I think the translation there from Finnish was actually, in the original Finnish, it would be, "Dear Steve, please don't ask us that. We don't have an official answer."
Yeah, maybe.
Interestingly, I did notice that internet radio is actually on the roadmap for one of the future parts of the Symbian platform. So we may well see it become a sort of standard part of the platform in the future, and that would be available as an application. I can't actually remember whether that was Symbian 2 or 3, but it was one of those.
But it makes complete sense when you think you've got music already rolled in. You've probably got podcasts rolling into music player. As I say music player, it should be a media player because you'll have video coming in there as well. I see no reason why streaming audio shouldn't be a feature as well.
Calling
it internet radio. I mean, it's just a really good idea.
Absolutely. I mean, as far as the user is concerned, they shouldn't really distinguish in one sense between the different types of media, apart from maybe to note that, you know, internet radio is, over 3G and therefore maybe more battery and potentially cost intensive.
Potentially cost intensive. Phrase of the podcast there, I think.
Yeah. The one other question was saying users have found that formatting the phone and memory after the 2.0 update made the UI more responsive. Why is this? Surely there should be no need. And the answer came back, you do not need to format the phone after the software upgrade. The speed perception is a subjective matter, and I can tell I have never formatted my devices while testing 2.0, and it worked okay. And I have to disagree with the Nokia representative here. I agree that, as with any operating system, it's not just Nokia version 20 on the N97. If you're having a whole new operating system, it makes so much sense to clear out all the old system files, all the old settings, all the old rubbish, start with a fresh installation, then put your data back on, and you'll be far, far happier. And so I know the official line from Nokia is you can just do it all over in place with user data preservation. You don't need to worry about reformatting and stuff. But hey, guys, you'll have a far better experience if you do. And to be honest, doing a backup to memory card takes 5 minutes max. Wiping the phone with the *7370# thing, that takes 2 minutes. And then restoring your data takes another 5 minutes. 12 minutes, and you'll have a phone that's going to be far faster and more streamlined for the next 6 months of use. I think that's worthwhile. If you want to see more of these Q&A from the Nokia, then do see the story and the link on the site, because it's worth a read. But we are hoping for a part two where Nokia answers some of the trickier questions, as we say. Rafe, you got a comment?
Yes, I just sort of want to emphasize the fact that I really think the PR2 release on the N97 does make it a different device. I don't think it fixes by any means all of the problems that people talk about with the UI on S65th edition, but it does make the phone, I think, a lot more appealing. And it's just the little things like kinetic scrolling throughout the whole system, you know, everything from the application screen, so the sort of grid UI views to the list views in music. I mean, and I think it does demonstrate how often these things are perceived. It's often cosmetic improvements, and I actually sort of have my doubts about how much they really make a difference in terms of making it more usable or making it faster day to day. But the other thing that it does bring is updated versions of things like Ovi Maps and all the other bits of software, which I think is to be welcomed, because getting the latest version, you do get extra functionality there. So I do expect this to significantly increase the longevity of the N97, and the same software as on the N97 Mini, which is a fantastic little device. And I think
proper cursor keys.
Indeed. And I think perhaps it's, you know, going to give something of reinvigoration to the N97 if sort of some of the people talking about the N97, where it does get a very negative feedback. actually sort of give it a chance. And of course, it's also worth saying that I think the vast majority of people that buy an N97 over its lifetime will be buying one with this new software on it, so they'll never have the bad experience that a lot of people had with version one of the software.
And, yeah, all the bad GPS, all the camera scratch issues, et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely. And it doesn't excuse them, of course, but it's worth noting that, you know, these products do tend to evolve over time now that things have got so much more complex in the software. And I think, you know, particularly with the camera and the GPS issue, it's a shame that they didn't get caught earlier on by Nokia, but these things do happen. And going forward, there is actually more to come from the N97. We're going to have a sort of download for Skype before too long. It'll be a standalone SIS rather than a firmware update. But, you know, they're talking about that's going to be deep integration into the sort of the N97 in a way that you just, you know, wouldn't expect from a standalone application. And there will be another firmware release, potentially even two, you know, PR3 and PR4. It's still unclear how many we'll get, but certainly there's going to be at least one more big one that will no doubt, you know, fix more problems and add more functionality. And that's a complete departure from what we've seen on earlier N series devices. And I think given that it's only 4 months after it came on the market, compare that to something like the N95, which is one of the few N series devices that did receive a lot of firmware updates, none of which actually added really major functionality in quite the same way I think N97 PR2 has. But
there was the demand paging.
There was demand paging, and that was a background optimization. But in terms of functionality, it didn't. I mean, it made it more usable, I agree, but you're not seeing things like the kinetic scrolling or big updates to the applications. They only actually came in later. Yeah. And those updates took a year to come out on the N95, and we've seen that happen in effectively a third of the time on the N97. So I think, you know, a lot of the criticism is, you know, a bit unworried and sort of amazed about how far we've come. And clearly the N97 gets compared to Android and the iPhone that's receiving updates. But actually the N97 has received an update faster than the original iPhone does. You know, they typically operate on the 6-month cycle or even a year in some cases. and similarly with Android. So I just think sometimes a bit of perspective, and actually I think the N97 PR2 update is a really significant achievement, which Nokia deserve more credit for than they seem to be getting amongst the blogs and the media.
Yeah, some of my favourite features, just the pressing and holding each of the keyboard keys to insert its symbol or punctuation. I love that feature. That's a big time saver.
Absolutely.
And also, I love the way you can highlight text. And because there's no control key for doing Control-C, Control-V for copying and pasting, you press and hold the Shift key, and that brings up a pop-up menu on the side of the screen with copy and paste. So you don't actually need the Control key anymore. So you can do control copy and pasting for within keyboard entry, which I think is a really nice little hack, as it were. Also notable is that version 20 introduced a fixed sync system. So at last, many of the sync operations that have been failing over the first few months will now work, including iSync compatibility with the Mac. So for the first time, people with N97s can now synchronize their data with the Mac. But previously, you had to go through another device or through an online service, and it was a right pain. It's now opened up the N97 to the Mac world, which is a very good thing. We're right out of time for this insight, so I think we're going to leave the rest of the subjects for insight number 94. So for now, it's goodbye from me, Steve Litchfield.
And goodbye from me, Rafe Blandford.
And goodbye from me, Ewan Spence.
All right, see you next time.